From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In some ways, people feel the same way about L. Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, as they do about Joseph Smith, the founder of Mormonism. For believers, Hubbard is a prophet, a savior. For critics, he's a con man, a huckster. Like Smith, he was immensely charismatic, and much of the reason his religious movement has survived and endured is because of the power of his persona. Today in the program, we're talking with the journalist Janet Reitman about the book she's written, which she describes as an objective history of Scientology. It's not so much an exposé about a secretive cult, it's about Hubbard's ideas, his new spiritual technology, how he merged science and religion by connecting them to the American passion for self-transformation. Inside Scientology, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Because its philosophies and practices can be so secretive and controversial, there have been a number of exposés and investigative pieces about Scientology. But that's not exactly how you would describe Janet Reitman's new book on Scientology. Sure, she explores the controversies, and you can't deny part of the appeal of the book is the aura of those secrets, which she does write about. But Reitman is more interested in how this religion works, the ideas behind L. Ron Hubbard's spiritual science. In 2006, Reitman wrote a popular piece on Scientology for Rolling Stone magazine, and she spent more than 5 years expanding that framework. Really, she says the book is about a global spiritual enterprise that trades in a product called spiritual freedom. She's writing about how L. Ron Hubbard merged science and religion by connecting them to the American passion for self-transformation. Her book is called Inside Scientology, the story of America's most secretive religion. And Janet Reitman is joining us today to talk about it. Janet Reitman is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone. She covered the war in Iraq for the magazine. Her article on Scientology was, as we said, the basis for the book. She's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York. And Janet Reitman, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I guess we should begin by talking about your reporting on Scientology. And I guess we could just say that it really began because Tom Cruise, of course, the actor and the most famous living Scientologist in the world, he was trying to promote the faith in 2004, and things kind of backfired. He began acting kind of erratic. That's how you started getting interested in Scientology, or at least the magazine, if I understand that right.
That's right. We, in 2000, Tom Cruise began this promotional campaign, we might call it, in 2004. That was the year that I was actually reporting on the war in Iraq, and I returned, I guess it was the end of 2004, beginning of 2005, and wrote a couple stories just to sort of wrap up. And in the spring of 2005, Tom Cruise kind of hit his moment when he criticized Brooke Shields for her use of Paxil, I believe it was, to deal with her postpartum depression. And then he went on Oprah Winfrey and the famous couch jumping incident. And you know, Rolling Stone is a magazine that obviously we have a significant celebrity component. I've done stories with Tom Cruise in the past, and Cruise is sort of known throughout this part of the journalism world as a guy who for years and years and years was extremely protective over his beliefs, and he would not talk about them in interviews, and he would even like walk out of interviews.
Right.
You know, if you asked him a question about it, his publicist at the time would get very, very angry. So the fact that he was doing this now, he was actually insisting that reporters tour the Scientology Celebrity Center in Hollywood before they could sit down with him.
Yeah.
This made us all really curious. And so I had just finished reporting on Iraq, and my editors basically said to me, let's find out what Scientology actually is all about. And so that began my my sort of journey that took me through the next 5.5 years, essentially.
Well, let's explain what the book is about, because I want to get to some of the ideas. And I think I got it right when I said it's not an exposé. I mean, you want it to be an objective history. Objective is the word you use.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is an objective history. It certainly is based on interviews with hundreds of people, both people who have, you know, who are embittered against the church, who've had some very bad experiences, but also, and really very crucially, there are a lot of people that are both named in this book and you know, and also who are unnamed but inform this book, who still very much believe in Scientology and really do value it. They just are not in agreement at the moment with the current management, and so they've left the organization of Scientology. And those people really gave this book a level of balance that I insisted upon, or else it wouldn't have been worth it for me to write that kind of book, because otherwise, you know, would have just been kind of a slam against the church, frankly. So, and that was not what I was interested in doing, and that's not what I think I have done. I think I've done as thorough of an explanation of Scientology as is possible.
It seems like the thing you're almost most interested in than anything else is why it has endured for so long and why it seems to work for so many people.
Yeah, it is really interesting, and a lot of it comes down to marketing.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a business. This is a spiritual organization. There are many people that see it as their religion. There are other ways you can look at it, but at the end of the day, no matter what you want to see it as, it is a spiritual spiritual enterprise, yeah. A commercial spiritual enterprise, and you have to pay for every single thing just about that you do in Scientology. You don't tithe 10% of your income. This is about paying for each and every service. Every time you want to talk to a Scientology counselor, you have to pay money. And to make that viable over the years takes a certain kind of marketing savvy. And Scientology has been brilliant at this. It was brilliant at this through the 50s when it began, all the way up through the 1980s. And it's been challenged in the past 20 years, I think. But it was brilliant for many, many years at just reimagining itself almost with the change in the decade and the change in the generational, you know, sort of trends and interests. It would attach itself to whatever it was that was interesting people at the time. So it's fascinating. It's been many different permutations. It's been self-help. It's been a spiritual quest. It's been an alternative psychotherapy. Kind of, you name it.
Well, I guess, and that's the brilliance. If we're talking about the brilliance, at least the phase of Scientology that was brilliantly marketed, that's L. Ron Hubbard. And I guess that this is where you say that he understood what you call the common American yearning for self-transformation. That seems to be the thing he really hit on, I guess.
Yeah, he did. I think L. Ron Hubbard himself yearned for self-transformation. I mean, he was a guy who had heroic visions of himself. And as a young man, he never quite lived up to it. You know, he wanted to be a war hero. He wasn't. He wanted to be a great, famous writer. And he was okay, but he was never going to, achieve the level of success of some of the other big deal science fiction writers who were kind of heavyweight intellectuals and scientifically trained. You know, he wasn't one of those people. And he wanted to kind of be the captain of his own ship. And he figured out ultimately a way to do that both literally and also figuratively. Yeah. And it just happened to fit right in with the times, which, you know, we were entering into a period where we'd become increasingly self-aware and increasingly self-focused, where psychology would become a much more popular subject. You know, when Scientology began in the 50s, there was still a very few number of psychiatrists in this country, if you can believe that. There were only about 600 of them. But, you know, by the end of the 1960s and into the 70s, we would have pop psychology all over the place. Yeah. And Scientology would be very much sort of part of that strain.
So his timing was good, too.
Excellent timing.
Yeah. So, you know, the question I want to actually talk a little bit more about his beginnings, Hubbard, because it's a fascinating part of the book. But to this really basic question, you know, is it a religion? And the United States has come to recognize it as a religion. But you say within the church itself, Scientologists actually see it as a philosophy, an applied religious philosophy. So I guess for most people, when they think of religion, they think of God and worship and, you know, love and compassion. But that's not the kind of religion that Scientologists see. Is that right?
That's right, exactly. It is a philosophy. There is no God. There is a sort of supreme power or supreme being. But the closer you get to that supreme being, you know, the more aware you become. And so in a certain way, that supreme being is you. You know, you're supposed to become godly in a sense, ever more powerful, ever more able, ever healthier, and in control. It's a lot of Scientology is about being and having personal control. So there is, in a sense, that there is this, you know, overlord that is sort of, you know, this great puppeteer that is controlling everything down here on Earth. That's not the way they believe. Mm. And they don't have prayer.
Right.
They don't have a dogma of love. It's very... it's very unique, and it's something that you know, any Scientologist or ex-Scientologist will tell you that that's something that's kind of lacking in the church. I mean, they purport to have it, but in terms of, you know, they say that they, you know, are, their mission is to save mankind, to help mankind, that they are the friends to mankind.
Right.
But they don't have that kind of turn the other cheek, you know, kind of unconditional love that you find at least expressed in Christianity, you know, in Judaism, and all the sort of the Western religions have this understanding that you love one's neighbor. That's really not so much a part of Scientology. And so it doesn't fit, I think, our definitions necessarily, our traditional definitions of what we consider religions,
yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it's not one. I've met a lot of people, young people, who have grown up in Scientology, and this is their religion. They've never known another. Their parents might have been raised as Jews or Catholics or Mormons, you know, or Muslims. There's all different faiths of original faiths that have been drawn into Scientology, but the kids only know Scientology, and so for them, it is their religion.
Mm. You've talked about how you were impressed with a lot of those kids, that they had a kind of engagement with the world and a sensibility that was kind of appealing.
Yeah, they have an engagement with other people. Mm. It's something that Scientologists have in general. They are taught, trained from a very early phase, whether that means as adults getting into the church, or children being brought up in the church, very early on in their experience in Scientology, they are taught how to communicate. And they're taught these very specific communication techniques where they really engage with you one-on-one. They look you in the eye.
With the purpose of marketing the faith?
Well, this can be used in different ways.
Sure,
it can
sure.
be certainly used in sales.
Yeah.
It's essential when they try to go out, and whether they are trying to sell Scientology to new people coming into the church, or if they're out on the street trying to interest, you know, just the passerby to buy one of Hubbard's books. Mm. But it also is useful in business. It's useful in, you know, people's just interpersonal relationships. I mean, it can be used in all kinds of ways. And children demonstrate this in a really unique way. Teenagers particularly, I've found, are, you know, sort of uniquely able to connect and communicate. And particularly teenage boys, who I've had lots of experience interviewing over my career, who are impossible,
yeah.
You know? I mean, they're impossible to talk to sometimes. And so it's a really shocking experience to sit down with a 16 or 17-year-old teenager, a boy, and have him, you know, even a boy that's had a lot of problems in his life, and have him just be extremely open and forthcoming and, you know, sort of explain himself to you in a way that you just, girls are very confessional.
Right.
Boys are usually, you know, they're
yeah.
not.
Yeah.
So I was very struck by that. And I was struck by the maturity of a lot of these kids and the sort of self-possession. They're very composed. And to a one, whatever their experience was in Scientology, and I interviewed kids that were still very devoted to Scientology and others who had left Scientology and within that subset, those who were very angry at Scientology and those who just sort of quietly didn't want anything to do with it. So I sort of covered the whole gamut, and they were all impressive to me.
Well, there's a particular challenge to covering Scientology. I mean, you talk about it's really difficult to discern the truth because there isn't any, you know, public information about membership or finances. The church kind of has this history of squelching critics through this litigation. And also, this is the other interesting part about it, is people who study religions, particularly, you know, new religious groups in America, sometimes they just avoid it because it's been very hostile to open itself up and to be reviewed. So right. it's hard to get at this religion, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems with Scientology has been that it's it is extremely sensitive to criticism. Yeah. It's the nice way of putting it. It does not tolerate any kind of criticism, let alone critical inquiry. And so, it over the years, anyone who has tried to investigate it or just examine it has usually met with a negative experience. And so people have tended to, it's been a chilling effect, you know, whether you're in academia, whether you're in journalism, you know, whoever you may be, people have stepped away and just said, no, not going to deal. So the people that do wind up writing about Scientology are usually people who have access to Grind. Yeah. And so you have to, you know, discern who is legitimate. And in my reporting, I made a very, very conscious effort to find individuals who were not involved in lawsuits, had not gotten involved in any kind of overt criticism, who are very quietly living their lives. The irony to that is that after, you know, takes a long time to write a book. This book took, you know, 5 years. Yeah. Over the course of that period, some of those people became critics. And you have no control over that, right. You know. They became angrier and angrier. They decided to go on the internet and start blogs. Some of them wrote memoirs. Some of them, you know, sued or became witnesses in other people's suits. That's all stuff that happened after I had found them, convinced them to talk to me, you know, interviewed them.
Yeah,
and
go on the record.
Convinced them to go on the record.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what can you do? But it was a very long process that I had to go through initially to find those people. It took me probably a year and a half. And it was a lot of work. And I should say that some of the people who are in my book not everybody sort of became a public critic. There are lots of people who are still very quiet critics, and some of them only agreed to go on the record at the very last minute.
Well, I wonder this. I did wonder if you felt it had to be kind of nerve-wracking writing this book. And in 2006, it must have been nerve-wracking writing the first piece. And kind of, maybe this is the wrong word, but kind of scary?
Well, it was really funny. I was not really, I've never been all that freaked out. I'm not really a very fearful person when it comes to things
right,
like this.
Right, right.
I would say that during 2005 and 2006, when I began all of this, the church was extremely active in their involvement in that article that I was doing. They were constantly calling the magazine to check in, talk to my editors. They made a special trip to the Rolling Stone offices at one point to have a little meeting with my editors, but not with me. I had to actually go sit in my editor's office like a bad girl while they all sat in a different room and chatted about my story.
Which tends to make you feel less scared, right? I mean, kind of just bugged.
They were just like, you know, they wanted to control the coverage. They were not going to be able to control the coverage. They wanted to be a part of the action of that story. And I was thrilled to have them be involved in that story. And they gave me this incredible access in 2006. I had like 3 days and we're talking 18-hour days.
Wow.
With church officials, very senior church officials, and who answered every question in the world that I could possibly have. And
but were they
amazing.
Trying to exhaust you in some way?
Yeah, they were. They were totally trying to exhaust me. But you know, you can either have that done to you, submit to it, or you can play back. And I said, well, okay, if you're going to try to exhaust me, I'm going to exhaust you. I had lots of questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the guy that was at the time the main spokesman for the church, and he was really like the number two or three official in the entire international organization of Scientology, a guy named Mike Rinder. He's now become a critic.
Yeah.
He then left several years later, and went underground for quite a while, and emerged recently within the past 2 years. but he was underground for a couple of years. And he, but when, you know, he's still a very much of a true believer in Scientology. And I think what he would like, and what a couple of other people that are associated with him would like, would be a reformation of Scientology, mm-hmm. not an abolition of Scientology. And there are two very distinct camps. Some people would like to abolish it, and others would like to reform it. So he's on the reform end.
Well, it seems like that, I guess it's like any religion in that way. There, you have the people who kind of believe in the literal part of it, who, or the people who see it as something bigger than that, and they're willing to see it change and transform and not be as rigid. It seems like a lot of faiths deal with that.
They do, and I think you have to put it into a sort of a historical perspective. I mean, this is a faith that's only 60-something years old.
Right.
And it has been an extraordinarily doctrinaire religion, very much to the letter, you know, kind of fundamentalist, basically, up until very recently. Now, thanks, I think, to the internet as well as other factors, there is a reform movement, and the people who are eager to do that reform are interestingly willing to debate, I've noticed, the worth of some of L. Ron Hubbard's teachings. Like, you know, they're willing to say, you know, there's a bit of a paranoid strain that runs through some of L. Ron Hubbard's writing, and maybe we should get rid of that. You know, that's not the time. You know, maybe we should, you know, accept that some of the stuff comes out of the 1950s, comes out of that Cold War mentality. We're not in that same period now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe we can toss, you know, some of these ideas that are extremely sort of punitive and controlling and somewhat paranoid. That is very, very new. And so we'll see if they actually succeed. If they do, then I think that Scientology could stand as much of a chance as any religion to survive, you know. But if it doesn't, if it remains static, I think it's going to be challenged significantly because there's so much information about Scientology out there, and there's just, you know, there are too many other alternatives. I don't see how it's going to keep growing if it doesn't evolve.
Janet Reitman is with us. Her book is called Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist Janet Reitman is with us to take us through her book that explores the secret of religion of Scientology. It's based on 5 years of research and interviews. It's called Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. So let's talk about L. Ron Hubbard. Seems like I guess there are two versions of Hubbard's life. There's that official one that comes from the church itself, and then there's the other version, and I guess it goes without saying that the two don't exactly match very well.
That's right.
I mean, the church sort of, you say, presents him as this modern-day Ulysses, as this restless explorer, spirit. I mean, huge words, I have to say. Incredibly large.
It's like Odysseus.
It's kind of amazing, actually. You'd think they'd soften that over time, but it's still really pronounced.
Exactly.
And then the other version, of course, is that he kind of lied a lot and just sort of made it up.
Well, you know, the thing that's so funny is that he had a pretty fantastic life even without all that, you know, embellishment. I mean, the guy, you know, was amazing at reinventing himself over and over and over again. And he had some pretty cool experiences. You know, for example, he would tell his followers that he had trekked through the mountains of Tibet and sat at the feet of llamas,
right,
and, you know, and met the Huns or something, or Mongolian, you know, whatever. And,
right.
And I mean, in reality, his father was a naval officer who was posted on Guam.
Yeah.
And L. Ron Hubbard, and before that in Washington State, and L. Ron Hubbard sailed through the Panama Canal. This, and we're talking about 1923 or 4.
Yeah.
Right. sail through the Panama Canal with his mom to go from D.C. to Washington, or from Washington State to D.C., and then sailed to Guam and stopped off at a lot of, like, you know, sort of other Asian ports of call. He took a trip with his parents through Asia, through China, a year or so later. I mean, this would have been in the 20s into the late 20s. I mean, what kid gets that experience? That's a really great experience, period. It's a great experience if you're growing up now.
Well, and he was a daredevil pilot for a while.
And he was a daredevil pilot for a while, and he did try to have it was a failed expedition to find buried treasure in the Caribbean.
Right.
But he did charter a ship and recruited a whole bunch of kids from his he went to George Washington University.
Yeah.
And he recruited a whole bunch of guys from GW and the surrounding schools to go with him and you know, search for buried treasure. And this would have been 1933, 1934. My years are always wrong, yeah. In the early 30s. It's really cool. He had a great time, this guy.
And so the question is, why did he have to make some of this stuff up? Or at least that's. But you know, what's great about that story, though, you tell about that expedition that he led in the Caribbean, which kind of turned out to be a bit of a disaster. You say
right.
that Hubbard had this quality that kind of defined his life, and that was sort of illustrated in that story, where he had this ability to spin this dreadful experience, a setback really, into a kind of an amazing story and a triumph.
He was an amazing spin master. He was like a champion spinner, right. And would put some of our politicians to shame, actually. He had this ability to, and I actually think that this is true, that he truly did believe in his own uniqueness and success. You know, he thought he was exceptional. Nobody else might have thought he was exceptional, but he thought he was exceptional, and he was really good at selling that exceptionalism. And so, yeah, he was immensely charming. Immensely charming. And I did a tremendous amount of research about Joseph Smith and the Mormons when I was writing about L. Ron Hubbard, because I'd heard that he was compared so much to Joseph Smith. And there is an interesting, you know, it's a similar quality of charm and sort of salesmanship and this ability to connect with people and make people want to follow you and listen to you and cheer for you. And that was what he had. Mm-hmm. He also had a very dark side, and that would come out more and more as he got older. But as a young man, he was, an only child that spun a lot of stories in his head. And, you know, as lots of only children are apt to do, convinced himself of things about himself that, you know, he thought were wonderful and was able to somehow present that. He was a gregarious, you know.
Must have been fun to listen
promoter.
To, I think, to hear a story. And there's this great story you tell. You know, he's 23 years old. And there's this fellow pulp fiction writer, Frank Gruber, I think is his name, who's listening to the story right. that Hubbard is telling. And he's sort of taking note. And he's like, wait a minute. You're only 23. You couldn't have spent 7 years in the Marines or whatever it was.
Exactly. Yeah. He was like wrestling tigers.
Right.
He'd been in the Marines for 8 years. Yeah. And I just think, you know, I mean, who knows? You know, was L. Ron Hubbard having a bit of fun with these guys who are all, you know, probably much older than him? Or was he just trying to keep up with them out of insecurity? You know, I mean, who knows? But he's very funny. He was able to do this. I mean, you can listen to his lectures on audio. You can get CDs of them. Yeah. And I think MP3s even. And you can hear some of the way he would communicate. And you can understand why people found him charming, you know, how he would tell jokes while he was, you know, this is like lecturing about Scientology. He would sort of tell jokes. He had a folksy way about him. There was a P.T. Barnum quality that
yeah,
he had.
Yeah, which is there. And I have to say, in some ways, that's kind of appealing about him. And he talks about mm-hmm. how he's not just interested in, as he writes, a nice car and a good job. He wants something that offered him, what did he say, a surprise over the horizon or something like that.
Yeah. He says that he was looking for this horizon, that he was basically tired of. He'd sort of done everything that he could do. The exact quote, actually, I have it, is, He was sailing at the end of the Second World War. He was on a ship, and he was in his early 30s, but he sounded, you know, just decades older. And he said, "The great era of adventure is over. I feel a little like a child who tries to see romance in an attic and holds tenaciously as long as he can to his conception, though he well recognizes the substance as a disinterested tangle of old cloth and dust. Mm. Money, a nice car, good food, and a good job mean nothing to me when compared to being able to possess the thought that there is a surprise over the horizon. But I have come to that state of mind, that supreme disillusion of knowing that nothing waits, that the horizon never seen does not exist. I am restless still."
Mm. He has huge aspirations. I mean, he wants something legendary, I think, is the word that he used.
Absolutely. He wanted to, you know, there's a very famous quote, he wanted to smash his name into history.
Yeah.
And yes, he wanted to be legendary. And look, you know, he is. I mean,
he is. You're right.
He is. And I think that part of my challenge in writing this book was to humanize L. Ron Hubbard, who has so often been just kind of, you know, sort of lambasted. He's been pilloried, you know, and made into kind of a joke. And the guy was like, not a joke. I mean, his organization was tremendously and is tremendously complex. And it continues to exist based almost 100% on L. Ron Hubbard's writing and ideas and that kind of thing. So, I mean, you can't write the guy off. And when you really look back into who he was, there's a lot about him that's really interesting and complicated. Mm-hmm. He has a very charming side, then he has a very dark side.
Well, in 1947, you write about how L. Ron Hubbard starts to complain of these certain ailments. And among them are these psychological problems. He's trying to basically get the Veterans Association to increase his pension in part. And the VA says, look, go and get some psychiatric counseling.
Right.
But this seems really an important part in this story because you say he takes an independent path. And this is where he starts trying to heal himself, I guess, with his mind?
Yeah, Hubbard had learned over the past several years, he'd been in Los Angeles, he'd been in a kind of environment of New Age thought, and he was particularly, he was living with a guy named Jack Parsons, who is a rocket scientist at Caltech in Pasadena.
Great story, by the way.
And he was also, he was also a follower of Aleister Crowley.
Yeah.
He was a secret wizard. And that's a very long and interesting story, but the upshot is Hubbard absorbed a lot of that kind of esoteric thought because Aleister Crowley had founded a religion that was based in this Western esotericism, this idea that, you know, you sort of ascend, there are ascended masters and all kinds of secret levels and things that would eerily mirror Scientology later on.
Right.
And there was a lot of, I think he also learned certain hypnotic techniques during that period of time. And he had emerged from this experience with some kind of a belief that he was an ascended master of some sort, an adept. He was a guy who was exceptional. And he was going to use some of the skills that he had absorbed over the past few years to heal himself of some very serious problems, mostly psychological, it seemed, that he was suffering from. And he wrote up a series of what he called affirmations. And that they were exactly that. They were sort of statements that he made to himself saying, you know, you are powerful. You are, you know, women find you irresistible. You know, all kinds of things. I can read a few. He said, men are your slaves. You are power among powers, light in the darkness, beauty in all. You understand all the workings of the minds of humans around you, for you are a doctor of minds, bodies, and influences.
Wow.
You need no excuses, no crutches. You know, you need no apologies about what you have done or been. He would, you know, and he used these affirmations to somehow propel himself into he had to reinvent himself yet again, and he propelled himself forward. And I think that in addition to this being kind of an astounding list of admissions in a way, psychological admissions. It was also something that clearly formed the basis for Hubbard's sort of journey into the human mind, which was what Dianetics was and what Scientology was and is.
Well, and it was, and it really caught on. I mean, when the book was published, I think it was, what was it, 49 when it came out?
The book was published in 1950. Yeah, in 49, it was the promotional engine began, and an article that Hubbard wrote called Dianetics was published in Astounding Science Fiction magazine, which was the magazine that Hubbard had been writing for previously. And in 1950, the book actually came out. And it was a runaway bestseller.
Well, yeah, Walter Winchell said it was revolutionary, and it was huge.
Right, it was huge. It was huge. It was really, you know, it was pop psychology, and it was, or as Newsweek called it, I believe it was Newsweek. It was the poor man's psychoanalysis, and you had tons of people who were, and remember, this is the height of the Cold War. Where everyone's back from World War II, but we're now going into the Korean War. You have a lot of traumatized vets, people with PTSD, who don't really, we don't have that language at this point in the 1950. We don't know what PTSD is. They have shell shock.
Right.
That's what we used to call it. And so they're struggling. They're maybe in the heartland. They're in places in the country where they cannot access psychological counseling. And here is this book that says essentially, if you read this book and you follow all the techniques in it, you'll be able to heal yourself of your problems, and you'll be able to journey into your own mind and fix yourself because your mind is essentially like a computer, and it's fixable. You just have to rejigger things. That's what Dianetics is. That's what the premise of this stuff was. Your mind is a computer. It has a rational side and an irrational side, and you just need to fix that irrational side, which you can do through these techniques, which is called auditing that L. Ron Hubbard came up with. And this is tremendously appealing to people in 1950, and it was also kind of fun because you would have these sort of encounter groups. You know, you're sitting across from a partner, and they're asking you personal questions, and I interviewed a lot of people who told me like it was a great way to pick up chicks. You know, like they would, I mean, in the repressed 50s, they'd have like little parties, and it was a way for men and women to kind of flirt with one another in a safe way. You know, it sounds so innocent, but at the time it was kind of daring.
Yeah.
And it was really popular.
So at what point does this idea of the analytical mind and the reactive mind, at what point does it become a spiritual, religious sort of thing? Does that evolve eventually, or do you think he has it all mapped out?
I think it evolves somewhat suddenly because what was happening was that people who were doing Dianetics were saying that they were having these past life experiences, because part of the whole auditing experience is to get to the heart, to the root problem. The idea is that you have these psychic scars that are called engrams, and you have to get rid of them. And to get rid of them, and each engram is associated with a trauma, so you have to relive that trauma to kind of clear away that scar. And some of these traumas are way, way, way back in your life, childhood, you know, it back in the womb. And then some people would go to some other life. Apparently. And so that said to L. Ron Hubbard that there was some spiritual component going on here. And it also, I think, said to Hubbard that, hey, you know, we can legitimately claim some kind of religious status, which would be great for us because then we could protect ourselves from both government intrusion and also from taxes. Well, and so that was very advantageous.
Well, it's an ironic term, a poor man's psychoanalysis, because it becomes incredibly expensive, of course, you talk about.
Yes. Yeah. It wasn't initially all that expensive, though. I think that that's a really important point to make, that, you know, even up into the 60s and early 70s, I know lots of people that joined Scientology that did not, you know, who were very middle class and who were not, you know, in any way looking at it as this exorbitantly expensive thing.
Yeah.
I think the expensiveness increased tremendously over the past, say, 20, 25 years.
But he clearly saw it as a product, right? That it could be franchised and it could.
It was a product. It was franchised. It had branches all over the world that were called churches. It had a standard product, a standard way of going about not just the auditing, but the entire experience one would have, you know, walking into a church. Yeah. There was almost an assembly line approach. And it was very, interesting. And it was standardized throughout the world. And so you could, you know, and many people did, get involved in Scientology in, say, Los Angeles, and then find yourself in England, and then find yourself in Denmark, and then find yourself in South Africa, and you'd be having a relatively similar experience wherever you went.
Janet Reitman is with us. Her book is called Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with journalist Janet Reitman. We're talking about her book, Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion. Janet Reitman, there's a crucial piece of Scientology doctrine that I wanted to ask you about. And many people, of course, already heard this story, and I suppose there's no keeping it from people in the age of the internet anymore. But it's this kind of highly secret or sacred, maybe they consider it sacred, sacred story of how Hubbard describes the cosmology of Scientology, the way the story of how we all essentially came to be here. Now, I wanted to have you talk about this, but how do you treat it? I mean, Scientologists are really protective about the story, and I suppose they see a conversation like this as maybe, you know, kind of desecrating this story. But you talk about it, you write about it, it's clearly out there. How do you talk about it? Have you thought about it, presenting this particular moment, I guess?
Well, I mean, this what you're talking about is a specific level of Scientology learning called OT3, and the crux of it is a story that every Scientologist who gets to that place will learn, and they will read it. It'll be in a closed off room, and they'll not be able to share that information with anybody, including anyone who is not at their level or higher. So even their own family members don't know. And there are two interpretations. And, you know, I try to deal with it in as straightforward a way as possible, which is that if you were to open this folder with a story, you would read a handwritten document that says...
Handwritten by Hubbard?
By L. Ron Hubbard.
Wow.
In L. Ron Hubbard's own handwriting. That he wrote in the late 1960s, and it says that, you know, millions and millions of years ago, there was this intergalactic warlord named Xenu who wanted to solve overpopulation in the galaxy and rounded up all the errant souls out there, all the people that were bad, you know, including people who didn't pay their taxes, all the undesirables, and basically sent them to Earth. Imagine Earth as like the Australia, where all the undesirables were sent to Australia.
Right.
It's kind of like that. They were sent to Earth, which he said at the time was called TGAC, and they were exploded. They were dumped into volcanoes, and they were exploded with hydrogen bombs. And their souls then floated up to heaven, to the heavens, where they were trapped in electronic traps that this warlord had set up. And they were then gathered up together and sent down back to Earth, where they were forced to go through a kind of a brainwashing, what he called implanting, where they basically were made to watch movies of all kinds of visions, of images, and that Hubbard considered false religion, wars, politics, like all kinds of different aspects of life.
Yeah.
They were implanted with these ideas. Reminds me a lot about that bit. Was it the Parallax View with Warren Beatty, where he goes and sits in this, he's basically brainwashed at some place. It's just like that. You know,
or Clockwork Orange.
Or Clockwork Orange. Yeah, exactly. And And then afterwards, after they're implanted, they're sort of let loose and they affix themselves to the matter on the planet, ultimately will affix themselves to physical matter, including human matter. And the Scientologist then learns that they are made up of these body thetans, or these these souls that have attached themselves to them. Mm. And each one of them are causing all kinds of problems. And in order to be a fully well and evolved person, and also to make the world well and evolved, you have to audit those thetans. Now, by this point in your Scientology training, you've already audited ostensibly all this stuff, this psychological stuff, sort of out of you. So now it's about these body thetans. It's not about your active mind any longer.
But okay, so let's say you get to that point. Mm-hmm. And let's say somehow you were able to avoid the, you know, internet chatter about telling this story. Let's say it was 20 years ago when you reach OT3, and you've already invested probably $100,000 at this point, right?
Right.
And you know, untold hours in the and then you hear this story, which for some is fantastic and outrageous and crazy. I mean, how are people going to react to that? Because that must be incredibly disorienting for some people.
Yeah. Virtually everyone that I interviewed, with a few exceptions, reacted like, you know, they had a what the moment, basically.
Yeah.
Some of them wanted to get out of Scientology. Others struggled very hard to figure out how they what did this really mean? There are a few people I know who were raised Catholics who then sort of just transferred the story over it and said, well, it's just like Christ walking on water or whatever.
That it's a symbol? It's not literal?
Yeah, it's symbol. It's just a story. It's like a Bible story. It's
but symbolic. Are Scientologists okay with that?
Well, yeah. I met a guy. One of my sources was one of my characters in the book was a guy named Mike Henderson. And he explained this to me. And he was still very deeply committed to Scientology when I met him. He was not in the church any longer, but he was still practicing his faith outside of the church. And he wasn't really willing to talk about these levels with me. But what he did say was that I should really look at this in a more symbolic way, that, you know, essentially this was a story of this awful genocide, this terrible thing that had happened on Earth, and that, you know, Hubbard was trying to explain techniques at Scientology, and that had left a lasting imprint on our planet, and that was the reason we had all the problems that we had in the world, and that what their job was to try to figure out a way to get rid of all that sort of bad energy, essentially, and that's what the auditing of these body thetans was. It was auditing out bad energy, and that makes total sense to me. I mean, I can understand that, and I think that there are a lot of Scientologists who might be somewhat on board with that explanation to themselves. I mean, I've certainly talked to people who have said, yeah, that's kind of how I looked at it. I don't know how many people read that story and literally believed every single word, because, you know, I mean, I think it's probably as many as believe that Jesus Christ really truly did walk on water and that Moses really did part the Red Sea. There are some people that believe that. There are some people that don't. They still believe in their religions. So it's I think that there's something broader in there.
Well, you write about there's this story about Tom Cruise, and we don't have much time at all, of course, to talk about the celebrity aspect, which you've talked about before, which is, of course, another element, another layer in all of this. But you talk about how Tom Cruise, when he first read the story, it freaked him out.
Yeah, he was totally freaked out from what I, I obviously was not there to see him freak out. But yes, from everything I've been told, he was freaked out. And he distanced himself from Scientology for several years, actually, after that period. He and his wife, Nicole Kidman, who was his wife at the time, they kind of drifted away for a while. And then he came back ultimately with fervor. But he went through a kind of born-again moment, actually, in the late 90s, early 2000s.
Another important part of the book is, of course, how the Church of Scientology evolves away from L. Ron Hubbard after he dies and goes into exile and then dies. David Miscavige, the leader of Scientology now, which you describe as not having the same kind of charisma, of course, being more rigid in his sense of it all.
Yes.
So what's your sense, I guess, as we sort of head toward the end here? We talked a little bit about this earlier. Is it it's It's rigid. There's not much movement. It's static, I think, is the way you described it. Can it evolve? Can it adapt?
I just don't know. I think that the current Church of Scientology is very much David Miscavige's church. Yeah. I don't know if it is still L. Ron Hubbard's church. There are lots of indications and suggestions that have been made to me that L. Ron Hubbard would be dismayed with the state of the church. And with a lot of the things that have happened, which is not to excuse L. Ron Hubbard. I mean, he did a lot of things that were terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, he was, you know, he presided over Scientology when it committed domestic espionage, a gigantic, gigantic crime in our country in the late 1970s. I mean, there's a lot of things in the book that...
His wife goes to prison, by the way.
His wife goes to prison. I mean, this was a major... he's very involved in espionage and in all kinds of sort of nefarious activity. So L. Ron Hubbard was by no means a saint. David Miscavige has taken the more punitive, negative aspects of Hubbard and elevated them, it seems. He's also done some positive things for the church. He made the church into a real religion. He actually gained them the status they'd been seeking for all these years. He has definitely upped their name recognition in many ways. He's upped their legitimacy in many ways. I think the very fact that I could publish this book and that it would be taken seriously by the mainstream as well as by people that, you know, are into Scientology, but there's a lot of mainstream people that are buying it and reading it and it's been reviewed. All of that is because of David Miscavige and the way he has legitimized his church. So I'm not slamming the guy, but I think that there is a significant part of the church today and its rigidity is rooted in David Miscavige. And it's that will need to evolve. And I just don't know if it will or not. I hope it does for their sake.
Janet Reitman, her book is called Inside Scientology, The Story of America's Most Secretive Religion, joined us from the studios of NPR New York. Janet, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.